to have got the photograph album. It makes a difference. And that's the value of the model, I think.
Yep.
I'm doing my best. Please, can you tell us what questions are like?
Yes.
No, I got that wrong. Please tell us.
We can ask each other questions. We can talk about remembering and forgetting. It's just when we're communicating with them. Yes, very, very broadly, it starts by an instruction to use your own album rather than interrogate them about theirs. So the simplest question, you see, when we're asked a question, like if we're asked, if Rachel said to me, would you like another glass of wine? I'd be going, hang on, how many have I had? Is everybody else having one? Would I have to pay because I'm not sure what I've done with my bag?
All this
would be flashing through my mind, and I'd be accessing at lightning speed the information I wanted. She'd say, would you like a glass of wine? It appears as if I go, oh, no, thank you very much. But actually, I've done quite a lot of thinking in between. The idea of not asking a question but volunteering for yourself. So if Rachel turned to me and I got dementia and she said, I'm just about to have another glass of wine, I'd be going, oh, really? Excellent. So to start with, you make statements using your own album, really. So if you want to know where the person was born, I mean, the team at Burford always collapse because I'm always saying, I met a man at the bus stop the other day, and they said, when did you last take a bus? Well, I can't remember, but it's a really useful sort of generic sort of description of a non-threatening place, you know, on the whole. I met a man at the bus stop the other day who said that his mother came from Brighton. Oh, really? She'd say, I don't think I know Brighton at all. Now, if I'd said to her, you know, what, do you know anything about Brighton? She'd have gone, what? Immediately. So, using your own experience and making statements. And there are those three golden rules, and that is the first, don't ask questions. But there are the four and five, and there are quite a lot more that come afterwards. Number four is stop talking as soon as the other person starts. So you witter on, but as soon as you hear the slightest thing from them, you stop. And then number five is don't interrupt. And interrupting, you know, you wouldn't think it was an interruption if somebody's telling you a story normally and you go, gosh, that's amazing. But you try that on a person with dementia, they go, oh, thank you. Now, where was I? Back to their album for information, which we do at lightning speed. Oh, yeah, well, I was talking about a story about that. On I go again. Not them. So you've taken scissors to that thread that they've got of continuity. So all of a sudden, body language becomes very important. So with the question as question comes using your own information, making statements, stop talking as soon as they start, and avoid anything except magnetic body language and eye contact. You know, so you learn to laugh with your eyes and not sort of yo-ho-ho too much, articulating words. It is extraordinary. Actually, honestly, if you tried with... at Burford, if this was a whole day, we'd probably stop and say, right, turn to your neighbour and now try and find something out that you've always wanted to know from them, but just don't ask a question. And you think, well, we had one the other day, and she said, oh, well, what I've really always wanted to know is what coloured hair dye she uses. She told me that before she started. And, of course, what did she do? She started off and she said, do you know, I've often wondered about different people's, you know, colour of hair. And the other one said, oh, well, I don't wonder at all. I use azure blue. You know, it's just like that. Once you get the hang of it, it's actually, I'm not just sort of saying it, it becomes incredibly easy. It really does. But I think those are the sort of, you know, starter tips. But you, honestly, if you practiced with somebody just for 2 minutes, you thought, you know, the next supper party or something, you just think, right, well, I'm going to sit here and I'm actually not going to ask a question, but we're not going to sit in silence. But as soon as the other person starts, then stop talking. So it's exhausting. I recommend it. It's good.
Kenny, I might not remember your name tomorrow, probably, but I will remember what you sound like, what you look like, what you're wearing, Now, is that got any connection with the venture? Is that enormous?
Slightly sideways answer, but I set up a bridge club years ago because my mother happened to be an international bridge player. And if I'd known what I know now, she'd have gone on playing bridge. And I had a very early referral at Burford, who was a county player, and I decided to sort of have a go. And out of that, I formed this bridge club. And we used to go over, I used to bring people over to Burford at the hospital to play, and then gradually I thought, actually, I could set up a club, and I had ideas about how I'd do it. And we play in such a way, and I don't know how many bridge players there are here, but we play in such a way, would you believe, that we're all very nice to each other, for a start, and we never contradict, and we follow those three golden rules. And the said bridge player, this is way back in the 90s, used to come over, and everybody loved playing with her. And it was a great joy, because they knew that she was getting something out of it, and she was going on playing. And actually, she helped their confidence, because they were starting, and it worked both ways. Now that bridge club has got about 60-plus members, and it really does only have a couple of rules. One is that you always smile at your partner beatifically, whatever they do. And the other is that you use the catch-all response to any comment, which is, well, I had my reasons at the time. And on that basis, it's got a lot of members. Now, the other day, somebody came up, and we're all aging in this bridge club, obviously. It's been going for yonks. Now, the other day, somebody came up to me and said, when are we going to have another of your patients from Burford playing? And I said, well, we don't actually have to. Because, as you know, one in four people over 80 develops dementia, so we're actually growing our own. And back came the response, hang on, do you think I've got it? And I said, you wouldn't be asking me if you got it, because you would know. It's impossible not to know that you don't know what's just been happening. So anybody that's got dementia knows they've got it long before anybody else does and lives with it for a very long time. So as soon as you sort of say, do you think I've got it, I know that you haven't, and I know what you've got is normal age-associated problems to do with retrieval, not with storage.
So my point was, why particularly names as opposed to anything else?
I think it varies enormously. I mean, I have a problem with faces. I don't have a problem with names, but I have a problem with faces. So, you know, I could have somebody who I spent half an hour with, and knew at Burford, and when they go, I did this not very long ago, it was a man, and I said, come along, Penny, put yourself together, write some notes. Did he have a moustache? What? You know, I really hadn't got that image. So that's a problem. Other people have a problem with names. But there's a lot of research into non-dementia memory situations. And I always say we send the wrong person to the memory clinic after diagnosis. It should be all the carers who go to the memory clinic, not the person with, you know, with dementia. That business about retrieval, there are some papers that show that in normal studies with normal people, with normal memories, the way to remember things, i.e. retrieve them, is to actually go nowhere near the fact that you're trying to retrieve, but to fill in all the periphery information. So, I can't remember her name. No, bin it. I wonder what hat I was wearing when I met her. What was it? Sunny? Was it raining? Was it a long way away? And it comes. You don't necessarily have to wait till the middle of the night either, which is when it usually comes. But they're very interesting, those you know, normal memory things. So, and now part of it's anxiety, I think. But we do know what we know, and we know what we don't know. That's absolutely fascinating to me. You know, if I said to you, who was the wife of Tutankhamun's aunt, chances are you'd go, waste of time, I don't know. Now, how do you not know? And we do, extraordinarily, we know what we haven't got. Whereas a computer, poor thing, has to go chunter, chunter, chunter through everything and finally says it's not here. Whereas we can instantly go, don't know. But you're saying, do know, can't find. Different.
Or usually takes 10 minutes.
Absolutely, that's the slowing I'm talking about with retrieval. Yeah, and it's very, very marked. But people mistake it. And the more we have publicity for, which is very fear-inducing, this current awareness stuff on dementia, people are terrified of it. Absolutely terrified. And people need to know that they would know if they'd got it. So, please, you know, it's self-diagnosing. You can't not know. You just can't. You do know. And you sometimes try to say to people, my mother used to say to people, I'm getting a bit bothered about my memory, it's ridiculous. And then I went, oh, Dorothy, don't worry, we're all like that. And she said to me, they say it's my age. She said, I know, I do age. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about something really sinister. So,
yes, how does cognitive impairment differ from dementia, and can one become the other? So cognitive impairment becomes dementia.
MCI, mild cognitive impairment, is and I don't want quoting on this, but it seems to me it's a moderately new label. I have a huge public liability insurance, enormous, but it doesn't cover medical matters. So I have to be very careful what I have to say about any of that. But okay, well, MCI is, for me, is a relatively new label. And we honestly believe that if the medical profession understood the photograph album, they would redefine MCI as normal aging. And the worry is that because we're tending to amalgamate services for MCI and dementia together on the basis, well, it's all memory problems, the crossover, and the worry of somebody who's actually got dementia being in an MCI type of environment where they play games like let's all remember what we did last week. Well, it's quite fun as an older person. Oh, dear, let's all think, oh, yes, oh, and, you can remind each other, and, oh, yes, it's coming back to me, oh, yes, yes. But then there's this person there with dementia, red. Raging red for a whole beneficial groupie session. Goes home. So quite worrying. So, yeah, MCI, I think we'd like to see the photograph album much more generally understood with the medical profession, and I think they do far less labelling of MCI and talk about normal ageing. It's being medicalised in a way that's a pity if it's going to be lumped with dementia.
I was just concerned about a certain person just being labelled with cognitive impairment. It's been going on a very long time.
You need to listen. If that's a friend of yours, you need to listen like mad. And you'll probably hear at some point her saying, I'm pretty worried.
Okay.
And if you try to tell me more too, don't ask questions, not sort of why is that, but gosh, really, that's sort of, it's pretty simple too, this one. And see what she says. Nearly everybody in those early stages of dementia would talk about it if people listened and didn't just kick it into touch and say, we're all like that. And certainly if she's in a group, a mixed group, I'd listen jolly carefully, because it's not the place if you've got, the mixing of them, I think, is a pity.
Okay.
The photograph album seems, it could be a lot of neurological spaces for it. If you've done brain scans of people with this, and what sort of basis is it?
this book, Contented Dementia, was written by Oliver James, who's a clinical psychologist. And we look as if we're going to get some research into the efficacy of the method. And we are talking about doing measurements of all sorts of levels, which are relatively easy to measure, and their relationship with cognition. But there's a very, very interesting paper that came out about 2 years ago by somebody called Feinstein in the University of... I'm going to say Ohio, and it's not. What's the other place to come to me? It's very likely.
Ontario.
No, and I always pronounce it wrong, and I'm always getting corrected by our friends across the pond. Whatever it is. It's very similar to Ohio, but it's Iowa, thank you very much, which I used to call Iowa, yes. Iowa. Thank you very much. University of Iowa, somebody called Justin Feinstein, or Felstein, and others. They divided up people, they all had dementia, and they put them in two rooms. And in one room they showed them a very, very sad film, and in the other room they showed them a very entertaining film, laughing. And then they all went home. And 5 hours later they were tested. Neither group had any recollection of the facts at all of what they'd been doing during the day. But one group was still crying, and the others were still laughing. And that's the first breakthrough we've had, and it was only 2 years ago, of something we've been saying for 25 years. Facts increasingly don't store, feelings do, and that was very clear evidence. So, I mean, there's an awful lot that I think will come once we can get a scientific study off the ground. I don't know if that's answering your question.
Well, no, I was thinking about more about, you know, brain structure, brain scans.
Well, there's another book called informally called The Nun Study, where a whole order of nuns in America gave themselves over to dementia research. And they've been studied life history-wise in their life. And then because you need the brain slice post-mortem for diagnosing conclusively Alzheimer's. It's the only way you can do it is after death. Brain slice. So they've all given themselves over. Now, some of the lack of correlation has been worrying. Sister Agatha, who was, right up until her death, was writing an oratorio for the order, her brain slice turned out to be rather like a doily. Whereas Sister Beatrice, who'd been as daft as a brush for years, had absolutely nothing wrong with her brain whatsoever. So there were sort of questions over that. And then you get the story, which is not really related, but what was the best one I heard, which apparently was completely true the other day, somebody going into Oxford and rehearsing because they were going to do another of these tests with the wife. And she'd made a mistake over the day of the week, which had been a bit of a blitz the time before. And so he, all the way there, he rehearsed her, you know, today is Wednesday. So she got this, you know, and then in she went. And then she went in on her own for the test. And then afterwards, the results were fed back to the husband with her there. And they said, no, I'm sorry, she hasn't done very well at all again. And he said, well, what she got wrong? And they said, well, the day of the week for a start. And he said, she couldn't have done, looking at her. He couldn't have done. She knew it was Wednesday, and a quiet voice said, but it's actually Thursday. So I think it's the world of variables, you know, it's quite, quite interesting.
At the back?
Maybe following on from that, if you say that medical people are not using your photograph album, how do they diagnose now somebody who's got Alzheimer's?
By testing their recall and something called the mini mental test, and then there's another one which is replacing it now. But it's a series of tests that do test recall. And I think they're also bringing in what's called the clock test, which I know started in Canada. A very eminent consultant who, years and years ago, when everybody was getting caught up, starting to get caught up in the scientific, and he said, the best possible test I could ever do with anyone is I get them to draw the face of the clock. And then when they come back the next time, I ask them to draw the face of the clock. And he said, here, I'll show you, over 3 years, the face of a clock by this one person, and you could see the degeneration. So it's basically looking at deficit. But I've done the mini mental years ago myself to put myself through it, and I found it the most alarming thing. I really did. I completely sort of lost the idea halfway through that I was doing this for my own kind of, you know, edification, and I actually felt totally traumatised. And I always remember the chap saying, now, if you could just spell the word world backwards, please. And how they've come up with that word, I don't know. I mean, I find it absolutely impossible to spell world backwards at that point. I still can't do it. And it got me, and I'm right, is it? You know, it's difficult. And, you know, count backwards from 100 in fours or threes or whatever, all that sort of thing. And, of course, if it's somebody with dementia and they've already been diagnosed, to go back for another test that makes you go, let me think, which we think is the silliest thing to do with somebody who's got dementia. Why not let them run on autopilot when they don't have to think, when they're running on consecutive? So it's quite a it's quite crude, but... and then brain scans, obviously, which are far from crude. I mean, they're very sophisticated. But I am on... Yes, I'm glad you're all... it's only here, because it's not my topic. We are... Our charity and our work is purely for people who have got through diagnosis, and we're reinstating them and treating it as a disability, not a medical condition, who's been diagnosed, and then a kind of hospice approach, you know, quality of life until you die with this disability. But that's roughly in a nutshell what goes on.
Yeah. Any other burning points?
Yes. From what you say, I gather that having dementia is a yes-no thing. You say person knows when he's got dementia. Couldn't it be that people have slight dementias, and so that you don't quite know? Is it a yes-no situation, or a gradual development?
It's certainly a gradual development, because I think if you saw that progression of slides, from we don't know when that first blank comes in. We've no idea. We only know when it's starting to be much more frequent. But I got my base knowledge came from my mother, and she was describing... she was an international bridge player, and she was describing an extraordinary thing that was happening to her very, very, very occasionally. But she would pick up a trick of four cards and actually not be able to access the information about, let's say, what colour it was, the last card, what colour, which is extraordinary to a bridge player. You know, bridge players can have all sorts of amnesic moments, but not really that one. As you're picking it up and you go to turn it over, to say, I'm not sure what was in it is very, very unusual. And she said, it's ridiculous, because at that moment, she said, it wasn't there. It wasn't that I just couldn't remember. That's where I first got this remembering. She said, it wasn't that I couldn't remember. She said, it wasn't there to remember. It just wasn't there. Now, that's the definitive thing.
It's like you said, knowing that you don't know who Tutankhamun's aunt was.
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
She knew it wasn't there.
She knew it wasn't that. And it's the immediate, you see, which we do take it for granted that we know. You know, if I'm just in the middle of uncrossing my legs, now how do I know? Was I going this way or was I going that way? Well, we do know. I know. I've just decided to uncross my leg. But the person with dementia is at the point where any time they stop, they go, where was I? And they don't know which direction they were going in. And they think that's very peculiar. They're absolutely right. They haven't lost their reason. They just know they've lost a fact of what's just been happening. If they're on the phone and there's a silence, they're not sure possibly who spoke last or whose turn it is. And that's bizarre. So they know it's bizarre. And my mother did. She was very, very articulate about it. She said something extraordinary is happening. But by then it was happening quite often. But since then I've talked to, for instance, a concert pianist in a sort of arpeggio situation. And it looks as if you just do an arpeggio and you play. But actually it's check I've done it, at lightning speed. You only need one of those photographs missing and you'll falter. Because you check and you think, well, have I, like the cards? So it doesn't get quite as well executed. And everybody around you will go, you're getting stiffer. No, it wasn't that at all. It was just at that moment. I drew a blank. I didn't have a blank. I drew a blank on what had just happened. And it wasn't there. And so when you get people in high skills, in a big situation, she'd have needed to be, you know, the equivalent of the Albert Hall delivering her arpeggio for it to have really, if it had happened at that moment, she'd had a blank, a moment, split second before, and she'd needed that at that moment to execute perfect arpeggio. Everybody else would just think, oh, she's, you know, getting a bit old or arthritic or this or that or the other, and she would know that there was something. It was qualitatively completely different from forgetting and failing to remember. It's just not having it there. But it is progressive, yes, absolutely. But by the time people come forward for diagnosis, they're obviously losing blocks, because otherwise you wouldn't be able to test for it. You know, a random blip. The surrounding information will do. But once it's, and you've lost a whole sentence of what's just been said.
So quickly over to the corner with Barbara, and then we'll come back, and that we'll make that the last two.
The demented person, especially if they haven't lost all their
photographs,
they've still got connections there, and the body is very good at compensating. So are there any compensating techniques that they could use on existing brain cells and networks that are working?
Well, the plasticity whole situation, I think, is very interesting. I talk about bookmarking the album as being a practical, useful thing to be doing, so that they can turn back easily to a section which is useful to them. And if you do that constantly, and it's in constant use, then that becomes much, much more useful and used, which if they didn't have dementia or they weren't having this particular methodology, they would never do, and therefore it would never be useful.
So can they be, you know, these people, can they have exercises to optimise what they've still got left?
Do you know, it's us that need doing the exercises. That's the counterintuitive bit. I'm not being flippant about the wrong person is sent to the memory clinic after diagnosis. The point of diagnosis, fine, we've got this position, we've got this album. Now the carers need to get there to understand it. And as soon as we hear a question like, how do I get my father? I have a sort of thing that I tap, you know, hang on, let's reframe it. We're not going to get your father to do anything. He's doing splendidly. How are we going to get you to not trip him up and to understand how you've got to be understanding where he is in his album, what he's using, how he hasn't lost his sense, he's going very sensibly back, and now you need to store in your album what he's been doing. You've got to work overtime with yours. And you need, as the carer, to develop a technique where you stand behind the person with dementia, as it were, metaphorically, and you just, whoops, the photograph page is back to something useful, without the person going, take your sticky hands off my album, which they'll do if you haven't got your own skills and techniques good enough. But when you get good at it, it's incredible, and the look of relief on their face when they find their album is actually just where they can be communicating. So it really is us who need to be doing things and not them. I honestly firmly believe they are the expert, and if we listen and learn from them and acquire new counterintuitive, they are very counterintuitive, these skills, because we don't need them with anybody who hasn't got dementia. But do you need them with them, and do they need you to have them? And I got used to my mother eventually. I could see that she was going all the time. She was, with the stress levels, thinking about measurement of stuff. You know, she was going, give me a clue, give me a clue. Anyone got a clue? You know, who are you? What are we doing? Are we... and once I understood that, I got very good at, here's the A level of the question, this question you were asking about. And once you've got the sort of basics, you get to the A level, which is how do you answer questions just before they're asked? because there's an internal dialogue that goes on with questions. You know, we all go, now let me think, I'm not quite sure, is Rachel about to tap me on the shoulder? I think in a minute I'll probably say, are we all right for time? By the time I go, are we all right for time? I've done quite a lot of internal dialogue. You learn to, here comes another bit, speckle, observation, detract, spot, terribly useful acronym. You learn to spot when the person is limbering up to ask a question. And if it's the most frequently asked question that you've got used to, you get terribly good at supplying the information a split second before it's actually needed, because by the time it's needed, they're anxious. So all of a sudden, anxious questioning becomes something we're going to learn how to not have arising. But it comes from us going to the... you don't need to go to the memory clinic, you just need to come to Burford, actually, on one of the speckle workshops. We've got three to start with. Questionless question for number one, speckle observational tracking, spotting for number two, and then something called verbal ping-pong for number three, don't contradict. How do you keep a conversational rally going without asking questions? Easily, when you've got the tools... But don't send the person with dementia off to a clinic after diagnosis. You'll just unnerve them, and they'll start retreating.
We will probably at some point next year end up discussing here the neuroscience of dementia. We're not doing it tonight. I did warn you, we're not doing it tonight.
Can I just ask about funding? How are you funded, in a nutshell?
Charity.
I usually describe it as lighting candles. We do a lot of it. And we're about to do a huge amount because I heard this morning that the research proposal from one of the London hospitals that, I mean, amazing, they are ready to go. And all they're waiting for is my quick note to them to say that I have successfully raised nearly £300,000 to get started. By April. Candles galore. But we got bought the hospital. The hospital was going to be sold. And I said I was going to chain myself to the railings. It's got some very handy railings that you clang shut, you know, and you lock it all up. And I was going to, because all our case histories were in that hospital. And I find it much easier to say, well, you know, he was standing by the hat stand, and the hat stand's there. And the nurse came past, and, you know, I'm in the right place, and so on. Okay. And somebody rang me up and said, you've made rather a statement about what you're going to do if they demolish the hospital. I'd like to know why. So I said, well, could you possibly come along, and I'll show you. And all I did was photograph album and dolly, but lasting a bit longer. And when I got home at the end of the day, my husband said, you must have had a very good day. Because they're buying the hospital for you. And they hadn't had much more than you've had. But they had got a person with dementia. They died, but they were in the family. They were given to good works. And they wanted help. So I'm just looking for them again.
Last bit of input then.
Sorry, I hope this doesn't start off on a long answer. The thing about
probably
progression,
will,
it's clear that it's progressive. It is inevitably progressive. In other words, if you can't start, you know, become aware that you're getting colds and so on, does it inevitably get worse, or do people kind of plateau?
Brilliant, brilliant question, I have to say. There's always a copy of the book for the best question, and that's going to be it. Because we've only had one piece of, quasi-scientific research. It was a descriptive evaluation by the Royal College of Nursing in 1999, just before the hospital closed. They came up with six findings, positive findings. People who have the speckle method... people with dementia experience well-being, they take fewer drugs, they stay at home longer, they experience less distress moving between settings, they are supported by carers who feel less guilt, and the carers are reporting a plateau effect in the disease pathway of their person. Now, the reason for that is that it's because we're using old photographs, an artificial limb, more and more and more, it becomes absolutely irrelevant how few new facts they're storing, because they're not using them, and neither are we. So somebody got stopped about 5 years ago, I heard it, in the corridor, and somebody said, oh, hello, John, how's Mary, his wife? And he said, oh, he'd been with us quite a time. He said, oh, how's Mary? Well, in one way, she's miles worse. But he said, I have to say that it actually doesn't matter anymore. So it goes on and on and on. So it never goes to no new facts. You'll always get occasionally a new fact going in. But it simply doesn't matter. They get to end stage dementia. But they've got their old, and now they're being used, and we're all learning to use them. So it's the equivalent of somebody with an artificial leg. How are they doing? Well, they're pretty well, actually. And just sort of to finish on a very positive note, it's the equivalent, I think, of I can imagine two people meeting in the street, and the one saying to the other, what happened about you? How's your leg? And the other chap says, I lost it. And so there's commiseration comes from the friend, and oh dear, and you know. And then all of a sudden the friend says, oh my goodness, I've just had the most amazing thought. Good grief, you lucky old chap. You're going to be able to join that club, that wonderful club that I can't get into, but you'll be able to, because it's only people with one leg. Now, he's not going to go and have his leg off in order to get into the club, but there are some extraordinary things going for having a blanking album as an older person if you are sure you are on green. Because one very important thing, you don't get bored of a repetition of what you enjoy, anything like your counterpart who hasn't got dementia. Because you're not storing the facts of where that enjoyment came from. It is magic. So the learning to love repetition, it's a carer problem, not theirs. They never tire. It's wonderful. There are worse things to happen than end up with a speckled care plan at the end of your life of all the things that you enjoy, distilled down to very, very little, that is eternally repeated on a sort of Groundhog Day. That you can only do it with a system in place of a team who are all inducted. Because you can't do it round the clock. You cannot do it. Surely.